Dr. Michael Kimmel is a sociologist, author, lecturer, and activist in the field of gender issues. He is national spokesperson for the National Organization for Men Against Sexism. His innovative course, Sociology of Masculinity at State University of New York, Stony Brook, is one of the few courses in the nation that examines men's lives from a pro-feminist perspective. He spoke April 28, 2005, at Portland State University. The title of his lecture is Mars, Venus, or Planet Earth, Women and Men in the New Millennium.
The easiest way to start to tell you about what I want to talk about is to look at the title of the lecture, at least the title that you saw, which is, as you probably saw, Mars and Venus or Planet Earth. Now, you all know what that refers to, right? That refers to John Gray's book, Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus. Now, how many of you have actually read that book?
It's KBOO, Portland,
you know, it's an interesting,
Oregon.
It's an interesting phenomenon. You know, actually, not all that many people fess up to having read it. But the reality is, I should tell you, that but everybody knows what it's about. Everybody knows what it says. That book is the best-selling self-help book in the history of the world. That book alone has sold 18 million copies in hardcover. And that does not even begin to touch the spin-off books, Mars and Venus in the Boardroom, Mars and Venus in the Bedroom, Mars and Venus in the Bathroom. Then there's the DVDs, CD-ROMs, videotapes, audio tapes, pen and pencil sets, baseball hats, bumper stickers, board games, TV shows, and my personal favorite, the therapy franchise. You can actually be trained to do Mars and Venus therapy. From what I understand, you go to Northern California, of course, and it takes 2 days. I assume that means like one day for Mars and one day for Venus. And you like go out, you hang out a single day, Mars and Venus therapy, and you get like you send 10% to headquarters. Now, here's the thing about that book. Not only is it the best-selling self-help book in the history of the world, but everybody knows what it's about. Everybody knows the argument. And the argument is that men and women are so fundamentally different that we might as well be from different planets. Cross-gender communication is an event of intergalactic proportions. It's that impossible. And everybody knows this. And it's sometimes in our interactions it actually feels familiar and right. But here's the thing about that book. That women and men are so completely and fundamentally different. Every single day that you, if you are a student here at Portland State, every single day you are living the refutation of that book. How do I know that? Well, what is the most successful educational reform of the entire 20th century? Co-education. Right? 150 years ago, most people were educated separately. And what does co-education presume? That you can sit in the same class, listen to the same lecture, read the same book, take the same exam, be graded by the same criteria, and nobody gets upset about it. Nobody goes to the dean of students and says, well, like, I'm a Martian and my professor's a Venusian, so, like, don't I get extra credit or shouldn't I have a translator? Nobody says this. And why? Because what we know in our daily experience is that women and men have far more in common than we have different. That on every single measurable behavior, attitude, and trait, women and men are far more similar than they are different. That the real story is actually the variations among men and among women. That's what the real story is about, not the small, perhaps mean differences in distributions between women and men. That's the real story. But how many copies of a book would you sell called We're All Earthlings? There is something in our culture that makes us want to believe that we are so fundamentally different that we might as well be from different planets. But the reality is, on every single behavioral attitude measure that we've ever constructed, there is not one that is categorical, not one that all men and no women do, not one that all women and no men do. So, my argument to you tonight is going to be that that's true politically as well. That not men and women are not opposite sexes. There's no war between the sexes, no battle of the sexes. That, in fact, men and women can be allies. That the things that women have identified that will make their lives better will actually make men's lives better, too. That's the argument I want to make to you. Now, in order to do that, I want to tell you about the history of my thinking about this a little bit and give you the alternate title of my lecture. The title that I have, but would be way too long to put on a poster. It's It starts, actually, 14 years ago, when I first started thinking about this and writing about this, these particular issues. 14 years ago, some of you may remember that when Clarence Thomas was being considered for his seat on the Supreme Court, and Anita Hill came forward to talk about what happened to her when she worked for Thomas at the EEOC. And you'll remember that the way the Senate Judiciary Committee treated her, they called her a woman scorned. They said she made it all up. She really wanted it. And after the way they treated her, the media had this phrase. This is the first time this phrase was used. You probably have heard it since. The media had this phrase, a chilling effect. This was going to have a chilling effect, they predicted, on women. Women are going to be less likely to come forward to talk about sexual harassment. Women are going to be less likely to come forward now to talk about what happened to them in the workplace. So my first question to you tonight is, have the media ever been more wrong? Well, I guess the 2000 election. But, there has not been a chilling effect. There's kind of been a national thaw. Women have been coming forward nonstop since October of 1991. To talk about sexual harassment, to talk about what happened to them in the workplace. So in November of 91, I sat down and wrote a little op-ed piece for what was then my hometown newspaper, the San Francisco Chronicle, and it was called Clarence and Us. I said, okay, guys, sexual harassment's kind of on the agenda. We really ought to talk about it. We think about what it means for us. And somebody read that op-ed piece and asked me to come and give a talk about it. I said, can you come to our campus and give a talk about it? I said, sure. So 4 months later, I went to give the first lecture in what has now been evolving over these years. And by then, 4 months later, the title of the lecture was Clarence William Iron Mike Magic and Us. Because in those 4 months, William Kennedy Smith and Iron Mike Tyson had both been accused of dating acquaintance rape. And Magic Johnson had revealed that he was HIV positive after he had, this is his word, not my word, accommodated more than 1,500 women. So I figured, okay, let's talk about sexual assault, let's talk about HIV, let's talk about all of these issues. So that's the beginning of what I want to talk about tonight. And tonight the title of this lecture is, as far as I'm concerned, I can take a deep breath for this. Clarence William Iron Mike Magic, Senator Packwood, Spur Posse, Woody, Citadel, VMI, Latrell, Aberdeen, Tailhook, Iron Mike again, President Clinton, Hootie, Kobe, Air Force Academy, Colorado Football, the Catholic Church, Michael, and us. Now, you know, one more month, and I'm going to have to, like, stop and take a breath in the middle of that. Now, here's the thing. All of you know who most of those people are. Most of you know what those names refer to. Because this is the steady parade of the flashpoints of the renegotiation of relations between women and men in this country over the past decade or so. These are the icons of men behaving badly. And so, what I want to talk about is why we've had this steady parade of men. Why there's these names that keep coming up over and over and over again. Now, you did hear that I'm a sociologist. And those of you who have ever endured a class in sociology know that while most public speakers like to lead off with a bunch of jokes, we sociologists like to lead off with duh. I want to read you the results, just a few items, from 2% of American women. In each of the surveys, 3,000 women were asked what they thought about men. Well sampled for race, class, age, religion, region, etc. Now, the first survey was done in 1970, and the second survey was done in the year 2000, 30 years later. So what you're going to hear, of course, is the differences between what women said about men in 1970 and what they might say today if you would assume that what they said in 2000 is roughly the same as what they'd say today. And I just want to read you a couple of items to give you an idea of the issues that I think we're going to need to talk about. In 1970, 2/3 of the women agreed with the statement, men are basically kind and considerate. Now, 46% agree with that statement. In 1970, 41% of women said, men's egos require they put women down. Now, 58% agree with that statement. In 1970, 44% of the women said, all a man really wants from a date is to go to bed. Now, 70% agree with that statement. And the last one, in 1970, 39% of the women said, all men are really interested in is their careers, not really their family. Now, after 30 years of the sensitive new fatherhood, the Cosby Show, at least the first Cosby Show, now 57% say men are only interested in their careers. So what's going on here? What's that? Well, I think that might be right. Now, the first reaction my students often give me, I should say, is, are we doing worse? I think that it's actually much more about women's lives. I think that what those numbers suggest is not so much that men are maybe doing worse, but that women expect more from men and they are more disappointed. I think that that is, and I think that what those data actually suggest, the enormous changes that have taken place in women's lives over the past 30 or 40 years. So that's where any conversation, it seems to me, about where men are at starts there, starts with the enormous changes in women's lives. So let me point to four areas of change, as I see them, in women's lives over the past, say, 30 or 40 years. Now, the first one is so obvious, I know I don't have to say that in here, and that is women made gender visible. We now know that gender is one of the organizing principles of social life. We now know that gender is one of the basic foundations of your identity. What you may not know, however, is 30 or 40 years ago, we didn't know that. 30 or 40 years ago, if you went to graduate school and said you wanted to study gender, there was not one course. In fact, if you said you wanted to study women in social sciences, there was one course you could take. It was called Marriage and the Family. For years, that was like the ladies' auxiliary of the social sciences. Today, there are women's studies courses and gender studies courses on virtually every campus in this country. But what we often forget is just how recent that is. The first women's studies program was founded in 1972 at San Diego State. It's that recent. That's the first area of change in women's lives. Second area of change in women's lives is around the workplace. This is arguably the greatest transformation of the labor force of the entire century. Women have entered the labor force in unprecedented numbers. Well, let me ask you, if you're a student, let me ask the women first. If you're a student here at Portland State, and you expect to have a full-time job outside the home when you graduate from college, let me see your hands. How many of you expect that? Now, please keep your hands up if your mother had a full-time job outside the home for at least 10 years without an interruption. This is your mother's. Okay, how about grandmothers? Okay, good, thank you. Now, here's what I saw from up here. When I asked about you, I saw virtually every hand up, except that the hand still stayed up. When I asked about grandmothers, I would say, now, what would happen if I asked the same question about home, graduate college? We knew that. Thank you. Because every guy's hand would go up and it would stay up for dad and grandpa and great-grandpa, because men's relationship to the workplace hasn't changed very much at all. And that's led to a third area of change in women's lives, and that is the balance between work and family. Not that long ago, women thought they had to choose between having careers and having families. Remember your hands for grandma. Not that long ago, two short generations ago, women believed that they had to choose, that they couldn't balance work and family, that they couldn't, you know that wonderful phrase, have it all? Can women have it all? Can women have exciting, glamorous careers outside the home and warm, loving, supportive families to come home to? Well, the answer to the question, can women have it all, is no. And the reason women can't have it all is because men do. We're the ones who have the careers outside the home and the warm, loving, supportive families to come home to because women do the second shift. Women do the housework. Women do the childcare. We have it all. So if women are going to be able to balance work and family, we men are going to have to do something different, and I'll come back to that in a minute. And the fourth area of change in women's lives is around sexuality. Now, this is by far the hardest one for us guys to wrap our heads around because we thought the sexual revolution was all about us. I mean, the sexual revolution promised more access to more partners with fewer commitments. Have you ever heard a more masculine definition of the sexual revolution than that? But if you look at the mountain of sex research data that has been collected over the past 30 or 40 years, there's one and only one conclusion you would come to, and that is it is women's sexuality that has changed, not men's. And the easiest way for me to describe that change is say women today feel entitled to pleasure. Women today know that they can want sex, like sex, go for it, get horny. And I'm not talking about some like bohemian, radical, fringy group in San Francisco or Greenwich Village here. I am talking about mainstream American women say that they feel entitled to pleasure. They found their own sexual voice. They know what they like. They know what they want. They know how to get it. Now, I'm a social scientist. I know you're sitting there going, how would you prove that empirically? Now, and also I have to say, you probably know that as a social scientist, this is not the kind of thing that would admit to an attitude survey. You know how social scientists think, right? We can only think in four categories, a lot, some, a little, or nothing. And this is not the kind of thing that would admit to an attitude survey. Like, how sexually agentic do you feel? A lot, some, a little, or not at all? You'd get no useful data. You need a behavioral measure of sexual entitlement, the entitlement to pleasure. I have one for you. I have a thought about this. How about rates of masturbation? This is the scared silence. Oh, no, he's not real. I got to tell you, you know, at Stony Brook, where I teach a class on sex and society to 475 students, right? A course on intimacy. And my students would be absolutely delighted to talk about the most bizarre sexual perversion that, like, two people do. But talk about masturbation, which virtually everyone's doing. Oh, no, don't go there. Please don't go there. But think about it. Isn't masturbation the best behavioral measure of entitlement to pleasure you're able to find? I'm so entitled to pleasure, I'll do it myself. So let's look. 1954 found that 41% of American women over 25 had ever masturbated. 41% in 1954. In 1996, the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago did the single largest study of American sexual behavior ever undertaken in our history. And given current administration, that ever will be undertaken in our history. And they found that 90% of women had ever masturbated. Now, you'll admit, that is a big change in a short time. From 41% in 1954 to 90% in 1996. Comparable rates for men. Alfred Kinsey, 1948, sexual behavior in the human male, 96% of men. 1996, socialization of sexuality, 97% of men. Now, here's another. Let me give you one more behavioral measure of entitlement to pleasure, finding your own sexual voice. Not its presence, but its absence. In 1975, the sociologist Lillian Rubin did a study of women in the San Francisco Bay Area called Worlds of Pain. And those of you who have read it, it's a fabulous book. 40% of the women she talked to, remember how we think, a lot, some, a little, or nothing. 40% of the women that she talked to said that they sometimes, or even more often than sometimes, faked orgasm. Now, isn't that a good behavioral measure of not claiming your own sexual voice? 20 years later, 1995, she goes back to that same neighborhood, and she interviews women again. This time, some of the women she interviews now are the daughters of the women she had interviewed 20 years earlier. Now she finds fewer than 10% of the women say they ever fake orgasm. Again, that is a big change in a short time. I don't have any data on men faking orgasm, so I can't give you that kind of gender comparison here. But I think you get the idea that in four very fundamental ways, identity, work, family, intimacy, women's lives have changed a lot in the past 30 or 40 years. So while women's lives have been changing so much, what's been happening with men? Now, the easy answer, I think, the answer that most of you immediately thought is not a whole lot. And I think that's partly true. It's also not at all true. I think, for example, the world that my father lived in. My father went to an all-male college, served in an all-male military, spent his entire working life in an all-male work environment. Well, that world is gone. There are only three all-male colleges left in America. There's no more all-male military. And there's virtually no job a man is going to have in which he won't have a woman colleague, coworker, or boss. So the reality of our lives changed a lot. What hasn't changed, however, is the ideology of masculinity. Survey after survey of every generation of college men for the past 50 years basically finds the same ideology of masculinity. College-age men in the United States today believe the same, what it means to be a man, roughly the same as what it meant to be a man when I was in college, when my dad was in college, just once said, basically articulated what he's called the four basic rules of manhood. So if any of the guys in here are having any doubts or questions or anything, just get these right, memorize them, get them right all the time, and you'll be okay. Here's the first rule. In fact, just do this one right, okay? No sissy stuff. You can never do anything that even remotely hints of femininity. We measure your masculinity by the repudiation of the feminine. We don't raise boys in this culture to be men. We raise them to be not women. Rule number one. Rule number two, be a big wheel. We measure masculinity by the size of your paycheck. Wealth, power, status. Did you ever see that bumper sticker, he who has the most toys when he dies wins? That's my favorite. Third rule of masculinity, be a sturdy oak. What makes a man is that he's reliable in a crisis. What makes him reliable in a crisis is that he resembles an inanimate object. You know, a rock, pillar. And the fourth rule of manhood, give him hell. exude an aura of daring and aggression, live life out on the edge, take risks, or in the language of Portland, just do it. And if you could live to those four rules of masculinity every split second of your life, you too could be a real man circa 1950. Because that's really when they were articulated and implanted. And I think what's interesting to me is each successive generation of college-aged men subscribe to the same ideology of masculinity. So what I want to do for a few minutes is I want to take those four rules of manhood and I want to pair them up with those four areas of change in women's lives to suggest the issues I think we're facing here on college campuses as well as in our country as a whole. Now, remember that first area of change in women's lives. Women made gender visible. Here, I think the issue that we're facing is that women made gender visible, or gender is now visible to women. When I say the word gender, what gender comes into your mind? Yeah. Women know that gender matters, but most men don't know that gender matters to us in the way women understand it matters to them. Gender remains invisible to men. If you teach a course called, like, Psychology of Women, Sociology of Women, you get like 95% women. Teach a course called Psychology of Gender, Sociology of Gender, you get 90% women. One of my colleagues recently, gender remains invisible to men, and this is political. So I want to talk a little bit about that, and I want to talk about it in terms of my own background. And actually, there's someone in the audience here who was actually there during this conversation 25 years ago. 25 years ago, I was just teaching at I was finishing my degree at Berkeley and teaching at Santa Cruz, and a bunch of us got together and we had this little group. You know how graduate students and new professors are. You know, we get so excited about ideas, but there were no courses, so we said, well, let's have a little study group. You know, there's this explosion of writing and thinking and feminist theory, but there's no courses yet. So we got together and we had this little study group. You know, 11 women and me would get together once a week. Read a text, talk about it, have a potluck. Now, those of you who know your history of feminist theory, I want to say that this is a conversation that could not possibly happen today, and for the reasons that will be obvious as I say it. And I want to describe, because one conversation during one of our meetings just completely changed my life. You'll remember this. I know you will. Two women had this conversation. One was white and one was black. And the white woman said, this is the part that's going to sound anachronistic now. The white woman said, all women have the same experience as women. All women face the same oppression as women. All women are similarly situated in patriarchy. And therefore, she said, all women have an intuitive solidarity or sisterhood. And the black woman said, I'm not so sure. Let me ask you a question. So the black woman says to the white woman, when you wake up in the morning and you look in the mirror, what do you see? And the white woman said, I see a woman. And the black woman said, you see, that's the problem for me. When I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror, she said, I see a black woman. To me, race is visible. But to you, race is invisible. You don't see it. And then she said something really startling. She said, that's how privilege works. Privilege is invisible to those who have it. It is a luxury, I would say, to the white people in this room not to have to think about race every split second of your life. I know my white students and my students of color have completely different experiences based on race. My white students go into the shopping mall, go into the Gap, and they pick up some T-shirts and some chinos and jeans, and they go into the dressing room, try them on, decide what they want to buy, go to the cashier, pay for them, leave. They call that shopping. My black students walk into the very same Gap in the very same mall. The second they walk in, there's something, some ever so helpful salesperson coming up to them with those little headphones going, hi, can I help you? And then every time they touch a garment, someone will say, here, let me take that to cashier for you. Ever so friendly. That's what racism looks like. We don't see it. We go in, we pick up what we want, we decide what we want to buy, and we leave. So, now you'll remember I was the only man in this little group. So when I witnessed this, I kind of groaned and I put my head in my hand and I said, well, what was that reaction? And I said, well, when I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror, I see a human being. I'm kind of the generic person. You know, I'm a middle-class white man. I have no race, no class, no gender. I'm universally generalizable. So I like to think that that was the moment I became a middle-class white man. That class and race and gender were also about me. I had to actually start thinking about them. And it had been privilege. It had been politics that had kept it invisible to me for so long. Now, I wish I could tell you that this conversation ends in that little group 25 years ago, but I was reminded of it just last semester at my campus. At Stony Brook, I have a female colleague, and she and I both teach sociology of gender. So every time I turn to teach the course, she comes and gives a guest lecture for me. When it's her turn, I go and give a guest lecture for her. So last semester, I go to give the guest lecture in her class, and I walk objective opinion. Right? All that semester, what my students saw was a woman. I mean, you know, Marcia, if you were to say to my students, there is structural inequality based on gender in the United States, my students will say, well, of course you'd say that. You're a woman. You're biased. When I say it, they go, wow, that's interesting. Is that going to be on the test? How do you spell structural? So I want you to know, I think this is absolutely important. This is what objectivity looks like. You know, disembodied Western rationality. Those of you who know, I have to say, now I have a good friend, a philosopher named Harry Broden. He said that's why you have to wear a tie. Because you need a signifier. You need to show that you are disembodied Western rationality. You need to have some kind of marker. Now, what could be a better signifier than that? That a garment that at one end is a noose and the other end points to the genitals. Let me put it this way. This here, this is mind-body dualism right here. Now, you didn't know it was a prop. You thought the whole time that I was like, what is with this guy? He wears a tie? Now, why is this so? No, let me give you one more example of how privilege is invisible to those who have it. Let me give you some other examples of that. We talk in this culture about the feminization of poverty. Why not the masculinization of wealth? We talk, for example, of women's wages as a function of men's wages. Women earn 74 cents for every man's dollar. Why don't we talk about $1.38 men earn for every dollar a woman earns? Let's talk about the bonus we get, the masculinity dividend we get just for having a Y chromosome, as well as discrimination. Here's another example. Virtually all of you have email addresses, probably pdx.edu, right? How many of you have communicated with someone in another country? This is an example that has nothing to do with gender. How many of you have communicated with someone in another country? What do you notice about their email addresses that's different from ours? Country codes at the end, right? Of course. So if you want to write to someone in Japan, you've got to put .jp, South Africa, .za. Even if it's a university, in Britain, .ac for academic, .uk. In Australia, .edu, .au. Have you ever asked yourself why only the United States doesn't have a country code? Every other country is... Because when you're the dominant power in the world, every other country is marked, every other country is labeled, every other country is other. That's what privilege looks like. It is invisible to those who have it. Let's put it this way. Only an American could write a song with the title, We Are the World. Now, why is this so important? Remember that first rule of manhood, no sissy stuff. Without making gender visible to men and to boys, without giving boys a way to feel safe, confident, and secure in their masculinity, that fear, no sissy stuff, that fear of being seen as weak, as being seen as a sissy, as being seen as gay, becomes the dominating fear of our lives. That fear of being seen as a sissy. We invent all kinds of ways to prove our masculinity all the time. And I don't have to convince you of this. You all know this. What's the most common put down in middle schools and high schools in the United States today? In every middle school and every high school in the United States today. That's so gay. And that's so gay has now become pretty much completely divorced from sexual orientation. Right? It now is sort of means the generic sort of bad, wrong, stupid. But at one time, I think it actually meant something more about gender than about sexuality. Well, don't listen to me. Here's the words of my favorite gender theorist in America, Eminem. Now, those of you who know anything about Eminem, I want to be clear. This is from before Eminem's great gay conversion. Those of you who know Eminem since 2002 know that in 8 Mile, for example, he was, you know, he rescues the gay man being assaulted in the parking lot. In his latest CD, he is like all over gay men are so great. This is before that, when faggot was in every one of his raps, every single thing he said. And so Kurt Loder on MTV says to him, what is up with you, faggot? Why? What's this homophobia stuff? And this is his response. The lowest thing you can say to a man is to call him a faggot and take away his manhood. Call him a sissy. Call him a punk. Faggot to me doesn't mean gay people. Faggot to me means taking away your manhood. You hear that? It's about sexuality for him. It's about gender. It's about taking away your manhood. It's about challenging your manhood. Now, this fear becomes such a dominant, animating fear in men's lives that we have to prove it all the time. Manhood becomes a kind of relentless test, always able to call it out, always able to, you know, to force guys to have to prove it over and over and over again.
You're listening to a lecture by Dr. Michael Kimmel, professor of gender studies and an activist in preventing sexual assault and implementing gender equity. His talk, titled Mars, Venus, or Planet Earth, Women and Men in the New Millennium, was recorded by KABU at Portland State University, April 28, 2005.
Now, let me move on quickly to the ways in which the next area of change in women's lives, which is the dominant way that American men throughout our history have found to prove our manhood, which is in the workplace, as breadwinners, providers. This is the way that most American men have, over the course of our history, proved their masculinity. And here I think we're facing some issues. Remember that first rule, second rule of manhood, be a big wheel, and of course the second area of change for women around the workplace. Here I think we're facing several issues. First of all, the economy does not exactly cooperate with those of us who want to be big wheels. You all know that the largest fastest growing job category in the United States today is not dot-com millionaire. In fact, of all the jobs created in this decade, from 2000 to 2010, of all the jobs created in this decade, 80% will be entry-level service and sales jobs. The jobs that have the lowest wages, the fewest benefits, the fewest kind of retirement plans, etc. That's where most job creation takes place. So men are feeling increasingly vulnerable in their ability to be breadwinners and providers. That ability to be the kind of family provider that fathers or grandfathers may have been is increasingly tenuous. And now, remember your hands, here come women into the workplace in unprecedented numbers. In 1991, the Secretary of Commerce under George Herbert Walker Bush, this is a verbatim quote, I swear, I could not make this up. The Secretary of Commerce under George Herbert Walker Bush said, and I quote, we would have 0% unemployment in America if women would just leave the labor force and go back home. Now, you all did not listen. And as a result, here come women into the labor force in unprecedented numbers, and here men feel increasingly vulnerable, fragile, tenuous about their ability to prove their manhood. This is what I like to think of as the political economy of sexual harassment. Not the quid pro quo, sex for grades, sex for promotion kind. I'm talking about the hostile environment. Reminding women that although they may be in the workplace, they don't really belong there. They're still just women. Oh, we'll tolerate you all right. If you know something about sports, but not too much. If you laugh at, you know, sexist and pornographic jokes, but not too loud, we'll tolerate you. But you're still just women. You don't really belong there. Now, I also want to talk here about an issue that I think we face when we talk about men's response to feminism or why men don't embrace gender equality. And I was on a TV talk show a few years ago, about 6 or 7 years ago, and this is a talk show that you're all familiar with. And one of the idea of this show was this was a show where I was opposite four, as we affectionately call them, angry white men. These were four guys who claimed to be the victims of reverse discrimination. They believed, you know, because as you know, affirmative action is reverse discrimination against white men. And they believed that they were the victims of reverse discrimination. They were furious about it. They had been qualified for jobs or promotions. They really wanted these things, and they didn't get them, and they were angry. And then it was my turn to talk after they told their story. And you probably know that, you know, academics make crappy guests on TV talk shows, because the TV talk show hosts always want everything to be completely polarized. Yes, no, yes, no. And, you know, and what do academics do? We always come in and we go, well, it's a little more complicated than that, you know, which is not exactly good TV. But this was before they figured that out. So there I was opposite these four guys. Now, the reason I'm telling you this whole story is I want you to hear the title of this show. The title of this particular episode of the show was A Black Woman Stole My Job. These guys told their story about how angry they were, that they were qualified, they didn't get the job, etc. And I said, then it was my turn. So I said, okay, I have just one question about one word in the title of this show, A Black Woman Stole My Job. I want to ask you about the word my. Where did you get the idea it was your job? Why isn't the title of the show A Black Woman Got the Job, A Black Woman Got a Job? Because without confronting men's sense of entitlement, we will never understand why so many men resist gender equality. We think gender equality will be a loss for men. Look, we have been the beneficiaries of the single greatest affirmative action program in world history. It's called world history, right? We think this is a level playing field. So any policy that you tilt it even slightly, we think, oh my God, water's rushing uphill, reverse discrimination against us. So I think we have to be aware of that. The reason that so many men resist gender equality is because we think it's going to be a loss for us. And what I want to do with these last two areas of change in women's lives is I want to talk about how not only is gender equality not a loss for us, but it may be the best thing that ever happened. Let me move on to that third area of change in women's lives, the balance between work and family. And remember that third rule of manhood, be a sturdy oak. Here I think we're finding that the very qualities we thought would make us real men make it hardest for us to be the kind of fathers, friends, partners, husbands we say we want to be. Now, this is true about American men across race, class, region, everywhere. Men say they want to be good fathers. College-age men say they want to be really good fathers, they want to be really involved fathers, they want to be better fathers than their own fathers were. So how do we talk about involved fatherhood in this country? How do we talk about involved parenthood in this country? Actually, Alan Alda, I want to tell you this one quote. Alan Alda once said, a man isn't someone you'd want to have around in a crisis, like raising children or growing old together. Now, how do we think about involved parenthood in this country? We have this discourse, which I love. It's called quality time. You schedule it. You say, son, Friday afternoon, you and I, we're going to have a catch, we're going to bond, we're going to get really close. That's quality time. Anybody in this room who is a parent knows full well quality time is a fraud. It is a complete hoax. Quality time is not when intimacy happens. Intimacy, connection, bonding happens the 38th goddamn time you are watching Toy Story. And your kid nuzzles into you and says, oh, Daddy, I love you so much. And you know full well it would not have happened without the first 37. I don't believe in quality time for a minute. I believe in quantity time. I mean, I believe in putting in the long, boring hours, doing the long, boring teen household tasks that nobody gets a medal as Father of the Year for. Nobody gets to write a book about what a swell dad they are. But rather, they do it. Nurturing, caring, loving is not, nurturing is not some mystical state of being that you have to go off into the woods and chant and drum in order to learn how to nurture. Look, nurturing, as we social scientists say, it's very simple. It's a set of practices, things people do. When we men do it, we will be nurturing. If we want to have the kind of lives we say we want to have, if we want to have the kind of relationships with children that we say we want to have, the only way to do that is to put in quantity. Now, typically we men have two phrases that describe what we do around the house. They each have two. We help out, we pitch in. I'm proposing that we simplify these to one word, and that word is share. When men share housework and childcare, we'll have the kind of relationships with our children we say we want to have. When men share housework and childcare, the women in our lives will be able to balance the first time work and family. This is not opposite sexes, battle of the sexes, Mars and Venus. This is a win-win situation for women and men. The only way that women are going to be able to balance work and family is to share housework and childcare. The only way we're going to have the kind of relationships with our kids is if we share housework and childcare. Now, this is not simply a personal lifestyle option. This is also public policy. We have three general workplace reforms, public policy reforms, that go under the general heading family-friendly workplaces, on-site childcare, flex time, and parental leave. So how do we think about these issues in America? We think of them as women's issues. But they're not women's issues. They're parents' issues. When men start identifying publicly as parents in their workplaces, we're going to say, I want to have on-site childcare so I can be around my kid. I want flexible working hours so I can arrange this with my partner. I want parental leave because I don't want to miss a second of my kid's early life. Now, any of you who have ever studied for 1 minute public policy know full well women will not get family-friendly workplace policies unless men support them. So this is, again, I think, a win-win. Now, let me just tell you a little bit about what I think some of the benefits are here. There's a psychologist at the University of Washington named John Gottman, and he studies successful, thriving marriages. And some of you may know some of his work. But I want to tell you about this because we sociologists didn't get this. We thought we only have two types of marriages in sociological literature. There's those that are intact and those that are divorced, right? And so we lump together under intact marriages couples who hate each other's guts to those people, and you know who I'm talking about, the people who, like you see them walking in the park or sitting at a restaurant, they've been married for 60 years and they're still completely into each other, they're still like looking lovingly in each other's eyes, and you think to yourself, how did they do this? That's what he studies. He studies the relationships that have thrived, that have really successful marriages. And what he's found, one of the things he's found, is that marriages tend to have different patterns. One of the patterns is the sexual romantic explosive passionate model, and the other is a partnership and friendship model. Guess which one survives best? The friendship model. Friendships are based much more on equality than is passionate romance, sexual attraction, etc. He finds that gender equality is actually an indicator of successful, thriving marriages. And how does he measure gender equality? How much housework and childcare the husbands do. And this is what he finds. When men share housework and childcare, their kids do better in school. Their kids have lower rates of absenteeism, lower levels of diagnosis with ADHD, lower levels of child-onset depression or any other types of psychological problems. So their kids are happier, healthier, and do better. When men share housework and childcare, their wives are happier. Well, duh. But not only that, their wives are healthier. When men share housework and childcare, their wives have much higher rates of marital satisfaction, much lower rates of diagnosis with any kind of psychological problems, actually are physically healthier. If that's not enough, guys, when men share housework and childcare, the men are healthier. They smoke less. They drink less. They take better care of themselves. They have preventive screenings to catch diseases early on. And they have much lower rates of psychological problems, any kind of diagnosis with psychological distress symptoms, etc. And if that's not enough, when men share housework and childcare, they have more sex. Now, this is an obvious one, right? I mean, first of all, she has a lot more time and energy. And secondly, she is not so furious that she's doing it all. That sounds like opportunity and motive to me. So this should be a no-brainer for us. Now, the fourth area of change in women's lives is sexuality. And here I want to talk about, and the fourth rule of manhood, give them hell. And I want to talk about two issues here that I think we're facing on every college campus in the country. And I know that, you know, you have, you know, far more, and sometimes when you're living in a place, you don't know this as well. So let me just tell you, you are, the people in this room are so fortunate to have so much resources and so many skilled people on this campus who do this sort of work around issues that I want to talk about now. The two issues I want to talk about are sexual assault and HIV. Now, we almost never talk about what's, you know, they're so different, they affect different populations, et cetera. I want to talk about some similarities between the two for a couple of minutes. I go to many campuses, I have to say, where there's virtually nothing on campus. Everything is sort of, you know, individual word of mouth about these things. They get one brochure during first year orientation. They get one health brochure about, like, how to make sure that, you know, you don't get STDs, HIV, or sexually assaulted, which everybody watches to make sure that they immediately throw it away. People watch to make sure that you don't actually, like, read it. I've been on plenty of those campuses. So sometimes you may not know just how fortunate you are, what kind of resources here. But let me say this. We don't talk about these issues in the same breath. I want to talk about them similarly for a couple of minutes. The first issue I want to talk about is HIV. And let me be very clear about what I want to talk about here. First, I mean, because a lot of you probably know a lot about the HIV pandemic. I'm only now going to talk about HIV in Europe, Canada, and the United States. And that is Western Europe, Canada, and the United States only. That represents just shy of 20% of AIDS cases worldwide. So be clear about that. I'm only now going to talk about Western Europe, Canada, and the United States. Second, you all know this too. Women are at risk for HIV. In fact, from unprotected heterosexual intercourse, women are more at risk for contracting HIV than men are. We're all clear about that. Now, here's the thing. In the United States, over 80% of people with AIDS are men. This is, in fact, the most gendered disease we've ever had. This is a disease that could affect women and men equally. In the rest of the world, it does affect women and men equally. This is a disease that women are more at risk for than men are. Over 80% of people with AIDS in the United States, Canada, and Western Europe are men. And this is not a sex-linked disease that only biological males get and no females, or like hemophilia. This is a disease that women and men could equally get. The rest of the world, they do equally get. But let's talk about why this idea of this gender disease. Let's talk about masculinity as a risk factor. What is the best way? Now, I imagine that you're going to be way too sophisticated for this question, but I'll try it anyway. What's the best way to prevent your risk of HIV transmission? Good for you. All right. You are American after all. See, I thought I was coming like to the People's Republic of Portland. I thought, oh, my gosh, you're not going to even say abstinence. And let me just say something about abstinence. First of all, I have nothing against abstinence as a personal lifestyle choice. You know, you could decide for biological reasons, political reasons, religious reasons, emotional reasons, psychological reasons not to have sex until you're married. Fine with me. But I should tell you that if you take an abstinence pledge, there are a couple of things you should know. First of all, most people who take abstinence pledges do not break them. They don't not have sex until they get married. They wait until they meet the person they think they will marry, who turns out probably not be the person that they marry. So they break their abstinence pledge with someone who they assume they'll marry, because since we're going to get married anyway, we might as well do it okay. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, we don't have a clue what abstinence means in this country. Do you know that of people who have taken abstinence pledges, there's a survey of people who've taken abstinence pledges, 25% of people who have taken abstinence pledges believe that having oral sex does not violate your pledge. 10% of people who have taken pledges believe that having anal sex doesn't violate your pledge. And 10% of people who have taken abstinence pledges also believe that kissing with tongues does violate your pledge. So if we're going to advocate abstinence, we better decide what it means, because anal sex and oral sex do put you at risk for HIV and also for other forms of sexually transmitted diseases. So it is not a foolproof method at all, unless we agree about what it actually means. Now, let me talk about, so now, and the other thing about abstinence, you know, is I have nothing against it, but you know, as the only thing we tell students, especially for college-age students, I mean, as an individual lifestyle choice, fine, but as public policy, is the only thing we would tell you, it's a disaster. And it's a disaster not for political or ideological or blue state kind of reasons. It is a disaster for demographic reasons that have to do with the onset of fertility, age of first intercourse, age of marriage. Here, let me put it this way. If you're an undergraduate here at Portland State, you will never again, for the rest of your life, be around so many sexually active, unmarried people. Don't you remember when you went off to college and your parents said, these are going to be the best years of your life? What do you think they were talking about? We know! College represents the crossing of those two demographic trends. Before you go to college, not as many people are sexually active. After you leave college, many people start getting married. This is the place. Colleges and universities are like sexual hothouses. Look, most people do most of their sexual experimentation during their college age years. I always get nervous. I know that there's someone in this room who's sitting there saying, oh my God, I'm a second semester junior, I better get busy. So abstinence can't be the only thing we're going to tell people. We have to tell them something else. And of course, that something else is what usually goes under the name safe sex or safer sex. And here, I think the problem is the phrase itself, safe sex. Because to men, the phrase safe sex is an oxymoron. You know what an oxymoron is, right? It's a phrase where the terms cancel each other out. You know, military intelligence, like after Iraq, that's obvious. Business ethics, or my personal favorite oxymoron, social science. I mean, to men, what is sexy is hot, passionate, explosive, spontaneous. What's safe is warm, soft, cuddly. Those must be the most detumescent words in the English language. I mean, when men hear safe sex, what they hear is stop having sex like men, which is why it's often difficult to get heterosexual men to subscribe to safe sex sexual practices, because it means the negation of their idea of what sexy means. Now, here I think we bump up against homophobia, because this is exactly how the gay male community has responded to the HIV crisis over the past 20 years. The gay male community has basically said, how can we make safe sex sexy? How can we eroticize responsibility? How can we bring safety into our sexual decision-making? So there's safe sex videos, safe sex clubs, safe sex everything. And isn't this, I would ask the heterosexual women in the room, isn't this what heterosexual women have been trying to do with heterosexual men around birth control? Because the difference between women's sexuality and men's sexuality is no longer what we used to think it was, that men feel entitled to pleasure and women don't. Both women and men feel into pleasure. The difference between women and men's sexuality is that men think safety is the negation of sexiness and women think it's its precondition. Unless a woman feels safe, unless a woman is certain that her boundaries will be respected, unless a woman is certain that her no means no, that her bodily integrity will be respected, there's no way she can give voice to her own sexual agency with which she is now in touch, with which she feels entitled. Right? There's no way, unless a woman feels safe. So safety is the precondition for women's expression of their sexiness. Again, this should be a no-brainer for men. If we want to have relationships with women who are as hot and as passionate and as sexy as we think we are, then the only way, I know it's a stretch, but go with me on this for a minute. The only way we're going to do that is to support women's efforts to end date and acquaintance rape. Because as long as women are afraid to go to a party, afraid to go on a date, afraid to work late in the library, park in a remote parking lot, work late in a chemistry lab, as long as women are afraid, their safety compromised, they cannot give voice to their own sexual agency, to what they want to do with you, what they want you to do with them, only when women feel safe. So as long, you know, and this would be a remarkable thing, imagine if Portland State was the first college or university in the country in which there was not one woman who was afraid to go to a party or out on a date. Andrea Dworkin once said, you know, imagine the world if for just 24 hours, you could imagine a world without the fear, without any possibility at all, zero possibility of sexual assault, rape, or violence. It would be a revolution. You'd never go back. It would absolutely be it would just be impossible to return. Now, it seems to me that this is something that we also need to think about. The only way we're going to have the kind of relationships we say we want is to support women's effort to end date and acquaintance rape. Now, I have a thought about this. Typically, when we do sexual assault awareness on college campuses, this may be different here at a place that actually has been thinking about this and really doing it quite well from what I've been able to figure out. But at most college campuses, here's what we do. We do sexual assault awareness in the following way. We say to the women, and the women only, here's what you do to reduce your risk of of sexual assault. Here's what you do. You make sure that you dress a certain way, act a certain way, go to certain parties, not other parties, go on some dates, not other dates. If you go, wear this, don't wear this. If you're going to the party, make sure you always go with another woman. Make sure you always maintain eye contact, never lose eye contact, follow each other to the bathroom if you have to, taste each other's drinks. Right? You've all heard all this, right? Oh, and let me just be clear to the women here. Don't not do this. Of course, you have to continue to do this to reduce your risk of sexual assault. But for a moment, think for a minute with me about what this assumes about men. It assumes that unless you do all these things, watch what you wear, watch where you are, watch what you're doing every minute, police yourself constantly, relentlessly, unless you do this, we men are out of control animals and we will be all over you. I think we can do better than that. So I've been thinking about ways we can bring men into this conversation as well. And I have an idea. This was actually done by a guy named Michael Scaris at first at Ohio State, and I've now adapted it and brought it to college campuses. And I want to show you, it's just an idea of how to bring men into this conversation. Now, the men in here are going to know what this is, but probably some of the women might not. You know what this is? Yeah, people say, the first thing is, it's the urinal thing, right? Yeah, right. Its technical plumbing supply term is a splash guard. This is a thing that goes in the bottom of a urinal. Don't worry, this is a new one. This is it's bright red. It's from Ohio State. And it's now at a dozen campuses around the country. Now, what I want you to see is what you would see if you were using this as directed, guys. You would see the following. You hold the power to stop rape in your hand. You see, because one of the things about rape is it also depends on the choices men make. not simply about women policing themselves, about where they go and what they do, but also about men's choices, men's agency. We have some choices. We could end rape in this country tonight if men made different choices about what we do. So men have to enter this conversation. We have some role to play in ending sexual assault. And this, of course, is a handy little campus effort to... wouldn't it be great to see the green and white, right? All the urinals on campus and bright... school spirit. You know, you could put a little Viking on it. And that's been basically my message for you. My message tonight has been that gender equality is not a loss for men, but in fact, the only way we're going to be able to live the lives we already say we want to live. This is not about Mars and Venus. This is not about a battle of the sexes, war between the sexes, opposite sexes. This is about allies. This is about women having identified for us the very things we need, ending sexual harassment in the workplace, balancing work and family at home, ending sexual assault on our campuses and our streets and our country. These are the only things that will enable us to have the relationships we say we want to have. It will improve the relationships we have with our friends, our partners, our children, women and men. Gender equality is not a loss for men. It may be the best thing that's ever happened. I want to close then with one line, with one sentence. Some years ago, I did this book called Against the Tide, and it's a documentary history of men who supported feminism or supported gender equality throughout U.S. history since 1776. I know what you're thinking. A book about men who supported feminism. The world's shortest book. But in fact, it is actually this big... You have it, Jack, no doubt. It's this big, fat book. Because one of the things that was so overwhelming was how many documents there were by men who had supported every single issue that women had identified over the course of our history. And I want to quote, in closing, from one of those documents that I found, written in 1916 in a magazine by a writer in New York City named Floyd Dell. The article was called Feminism for Men, 1916, and this is the first line of the article. He wrote, "Feminism will make it possible for the first time for men to be free." Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Michael Kimmel, a sociologist, author and pro-feminist activist in gender issues. He was talking about communication and men and women. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At 11. O resto é mar. É tudo que nem sei contar. São coisas lindas que eu tenho pra te dar. Fundamental é mesmo o amor. É impossível ser feliz sozinho. Da primeira vez era assim da.
Singing Jobim's Wave. Well, it's 11 o'clock in the morning here at KBOO in Portland, Oregon. It's time now for today's Democracy Now!